Okay.
Hi, everybody. Sorry for the delay. Welcome to the stream. Hopefully, everybody can see us now. Tonight we have Classical Theist on along with Paulagia. Paulagia is pinch-hitting for us, so we'd like to say thank you to him and also to Classical Theist for joining us this evening. We are going to have a discussion about Thomism. We would also like to thank all of the people in the background who have been providing tech support for us as we are going through trying to implement a new applet to make ourselves a little bit more visually interesting during the stream. This evening, we are using Hangouts, however, so we are sorry for the delay, guys. So I'm going to give everybody an opportunity to just introduce themselves briefly and kind of explain their point of view. And I'm going to start with Classical Theist. And Classical Theist, I know you must be practiced because you went through this before and while we weren't live. So
Right, right,
I'm
right.
sure it'll be even more refined than the first time. The first time was great.
Yeah, so my YouTube channel is just named Classical Theist. I pretty much devote it to trying to introduce the philosophy and the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas into the discussion and the debate concerning not just atheism, but also secular philosophies in general. To which I think the philosophy and the tradition of Thomas Aquinas is of great value. I not only the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas, but I also focus on the classical theism, which I distinguish from theistic personalism, the former being my own tradition, which I think is actually better representative of the history of Christian thought, whereas theistic personalism, I think, is better represented by people like William Lane Craig, Alvin Plantinga, William Paley, Kent Hovind, these types of people that are a lot more popular, but at the same time, I consider to be actually a minority position among the history of Christian intellectual thought. And so I think that's kind of where I come from.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. So, Paul, did you mind giving everybody just a little bit of a brief explanation of your background in your theological, or I suppose in this instance, lack of theological perspective?
Sure. I'm Paul. My channel name is Paulogia, Paulogia, which is a play on the Greek word apologia. For those of you who are familiar with that, you can enjoy the joke or not.
I thought it was funny.
Cool. Although some people have suggested that I need to change my name to Saul because I grew up a theist and spent many decades as a theist, including going to Bible school and doing youth ministry. I was obviously, so I consider myself a former Christian. Specifically, I grew up as a Mennonite and have been in churches of other traditions as well. Though I think that CT would probably call me what he calls the minority
A
view,
heretic that
a
needs to
heretic.
burn.
That's
Yeah.
right. Yes, even when I was a believer, you probably
Yes.
maybe that. So, but anyway, that's a bit of my
The
background.
Inquisition did nothing wrong.
So where are we going to start?
All right. Well, we were going to have a discussion about Thomism this evening. So, one of the things that Godless Cranium and I had a discussion about prior was how we find it difficult to reconcile our conceptions of God, especially the
Yeah.
Christian God, because classical theists you purport to being a Christian. As simplistic and not being comprised of any complex parts or not being complex at all, because you, if I'm understanding correctly, see God as an entity as the essence of sort of simplicity and being comprised of no parts. So we were hoping that you might be able to present that viewpoint in
Yeah.
as sort of concise and palatable a way as possible. And
Yeah,
Paul,
sure.
being a former theist, might be able to kind of
Right.
bring up perceptions to the contrary.
Well,
Oh,
and before
yeah.
we and I
Go
oh,
ahead.
sorry, I just wanted to also add that I wanted to know all the things that Shannon just said laid out, but also why that would matter as
Yeah.
far as why it would matter.
So,
Well, before we start, CT, sorry to interrupt, but
yeah,
I
go
actually
ahead.
just want to first acknowledge the that I wasn't originally supposed to be here. Ozymandias was supposed to be the guest today, and he was, of course, has a very deep philosophical background where I do not. My background is actually strangely enough, in computer science, but I kind of feel like in some ways, some of the logical constructions and the, and, you know, I used to design hardware and software. So, you know, AND gates, NOT gates, OR gates, you know, all that kind of stuff. I feel like I can kind of follow in general some of these logical constructions, but I actually wanted to just ask a few questions if I could, so that I am up to speed a little bit more than me. Unfortunately, Ozzy's not here. So I just wanted to make sure that I'm on the right page when I'm talking to you about a couple of things. Can we clarify just a couple of things? So one of the first ones I wanted to, could you explain, and I want to make sure I'm getting this right, the difference between a valid argument and a sound argument?
Yeah. So validity and soundness are distinct but not separable. So a sound argument requires true premises and valid logic, whereas logical validity is just that. It doesn't necessarily need true premises, but the logic can still be valid. In other words, the conclusion can still would still follow logically, but it wouldn't be sound because the premises wouldn't be true. But if you have true premises and they tie together in a logically valid way, then you have a sound argument. So in essence, a sound argument actually gives you truth, whereas just a valid argument doesn't necessarily give you truth, but it does tell you that the logic of that argument is valid. It's just the premises that you'd have a problem with.
Okay, good. I think I had that straight. And then how would you be able to, what would a normal person be able to do to tell the difference between a valid, something that's merely valid or something that's valid and sound?
Yeah, well, that's mainly discerned as to whether or not the premises are true. You know, if you take, you know, the most classic example, you know, premise one, Socrates is a, or no, premise one, all men are mortal. You know, premise two, Socrates is a man. Conclusion, therefore, Socrates is mortal. Well, we know that's a sound argument because we know that mortality is a feature of human beings. And because we know mortality is a feature of human beings, if you take a particular human being such as Socrates, you would therefore be able to tell that the argument is not only just valid. In other words, it's valid because, you know, if all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, then the conclusion would necessarily follow logically that he is mortal. But it's also sound because we know that the premise is true that mortality is, you know, a quality of, you know, being a human being.
But so if we found out that Highlander was true and that there was an immortal person.
Then the argument would be unsound, but it would still be valid because the logic would still.
Right. But we would, I guess, in essence, there can be observations that show that you test it against observation, right?
Yeah. And anything that we get in an argument is going to be derived from sense data in one way or another. That's actually, interestingly enough, one of the primary, it's interesting because a lot of people talk about empiricism and they think, oh, that's just David Hume, that's just atheist stuff. But interestingly enough, one of the essential maxims in Thomistic philosophy is that, it has a Latin phrase, but I don't remember the Latin, it translates that nothing is in the intellect that was not first in the senses. So it starts with sensation, and even anything that we ultimately say about God is going to be derived ultimately from from his effects through sensation, through sense experience. We derive certain qualities of sense experience, and then make logical deductions based on those. So okay, cool. I'm very much with you on that.
Cool. So okay, I think we're on the same page on all that, which I've just sometimes I haven't been so. Awesome. Mm-hmm. So now proceed, I guess.
Yeah. So Shannon brought up the question of simplicity, and that's really important. It goes back all the way to ancient Greece. It goes back before Christianity, by the way. Plato and Aristotle, and pretty much even before Socrates, the central metaphysical question was, how do you reconcile the question of the one and the many? Essentially, if there are many things, and yet they all share, you know, something in common, how do you reconcile that? And a lot of pre-Socratic philosophers tried to solve it through various ways. Ultimately, though, it gets picked up by Plato and then Aristotle and then Plotinus. They conceive of the idea of pure act, of pure actuality, of pure being, pure subsistent being. and they refer to that as the divine. And one of the central qualities of the divine is that it is absolutely simple, that is, without parts. Now, that's very important because if you're going to have an idea of God as the ultimate cause of the world, ultimate source of all being, a necessary quality of that would have to be simplicity, a lacking of constituent parts. And that's because if something is composed of parts, if something is composed of parts in order for it to exist, as for example, you know, a tree is composed of its
but parts would have to precede it because parts would have had to exist
right,
before that thing
the
existed
parts are,
in order for those parts to be a part of that thing.
Yeah.
Is that,
and not just in time either. Even if, for example, you know, it's a stupid thing to say, but you know, even if the tree existed forever, it would still be dependent upon its structure. It would still be the tree as a whole, to be a unified whole, is dependent upon the parts out of which it's made. So if that was the case with God, then I think the question that the atheist brings up all the time, well, what made God? That would be a very valid objection. Because if God were composed of different parts, let's say his power was a part of his essence in conjunction with his wisdom, which was another part, and his intellect was another part of him, and his existence was another part of him, well then he couldn't be the ultimate being, because he would be dependent upon the parts out of which he's composed. And Richard Dawkins makes that point, but the problem is he I don't think he was ever aware that the Christianity, Christian intellectuals throughout history, up until modern times, really, divine simplicity only gets questioned around, you know, the modern era. I think he assumed that we thought that God is some complex entity composed of different parts, like some super being that's just radically complex, a super intelligence, one being among many, the supreme being that's, you know, he's got his intelligence over there, he's got his deliberation over there, he's got his providence over there, and it all just comes together in this, you know, mess of a super being, basically, a cosmic superhero, in other words. And Richard Dawkins makes the point that, well, then we have to ask the question of where did that come from? And he's quite right, if he's composed of parts, because you would, even Richard Dawkins admits that you have to ultimately get down to simplicity. You have to ultimately get down to a starting point that is not a composite. And
are you not
that's
arguing
something
here
yeah,
that it sounds to me like you're saying that because the God that is described couldn't be made of parts
or components, yeah.
Components, we're saying, well, therefore God is simple, as opposed to possibly saying, well, there, what wouldn't the logical conclusion be? Therefore, there cannot be a God.
Well, that's that would be a good point if you're saying that because God couldn't be composed of parts, therefore there cannot be a composite God. I'm with you there. But the problem is most Christians throughout history, I think the consensus of the theistic intellectual tradition has designated divine precisely through simplicity. Simplicity is the most central predication that we would predicate of what is divine as opposed to created being, as opposed to contingent being. It's really the question of simplicity that's behind the more classical Thomistic arguments for God's existence. It's not, we don't really start with this, and St. Thomas Aquinas doesn't do this either. He doesn't start with some, you know, preconceived God entity and just shoehorn it into his arguments and say, well, I'm just going to also call him simple because that solves a lot of conundrums. No, we take the conclusion of the argument. You know, you take whatever argument you want. You can have his argument from change. You can have his argument from degrees. You can have his argument from contingency. The conclusion of that argument, we're ascribing to that the nominal label God. precisely because it is ultimately non-contingent, non-dependent. And the hallmark of being not dependent is precisely simplicity. And, and it ultimately gets to the question, well, we can get into more what simplicity actually means a bit later, but I guess that's what I'll say to that.
What I had one question. So if it's without parts, how do Thomas think of the Trinity, right? Because I would
yeah,
that three
that's
parts.
A very good question. That's a very good question. If you, it's actually interesting because the early, you know, the Trinity was a very controversial idea in the beginning of Christianity. You had a dozen church councils debating the issue. You had all sorts of different ideas about it. One of the ideas about the Trinity that got, you know, anathematized, basically declared as heretical, is partialism, which is to say that the Father, the Son, and the Spirit are three parts of God. That was declared from the very beginning as being heretical. Now, it raises a logical question, you know, then what does it mean to say that the Father is not the Son and the Son is not the Spirit, and yet they're all, you're trying to say that the divine essence is somehow absolutely simple? That's a very good question.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily mean that, even if they were the same thing, they would still serve three different functions, right? So it would still be three different parts.
Well, it was a very complex issue, but that's not entirely what we say. That's good. Gets into another heretical idea that was tossed out, that, you know, they had the idea of the Son being the Redeemer and the Spirit being the Sanctifier, so they were different in that sense. What's meant by Father, Son, and Spirit are what the early tradition will call relations. In other words, the Father is only distinct from the Son, and the Son is only distinct from the Spirit by relation of origin. And the reason we say that there are these relations is ultimately gets down to the question of God being self-communicative. In other words, being in some way self-emptying. And we get that intuition first from the fact of creation. If creation happened, then God has clearly outpoured himself in some way. He has imbued being to things other than himself. And so the question is, in that activity of God, there are different...
Even that doesn't make sense to me, because you're mm-hmm. saying, you said earlier about wisdom and intelligence all making up, if God possessed those separately, that would be parts, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if
right.
he decided to do an action, that would be part of intelligence, right? Because you'd have to be intelligent to make an action.
Well, I'm not saying that God, see, then that gets into another question about attributes. When we say that, like, I don't deny that God is intellectual, and that God is deliberative. You know, he is willful, or that he has wisdom, or any of these things. But it's how we understand these different attributes in relation to the essence. So I often use the analogy of a prism of light. If you think about a prism of light, well, we see different colors, right? A multiplicity of colors refracted right through the prism, but of course, we know that whiteness, white light, contains, you know, the multiplicity of colors, and they only diversify because we see them through the prism.
Can we talk about one of those attributes?
Sure.
Unfortunately, Trinity tends to bore me because you ask, you know, 10 Christians to explain it, and you'll get 15 answers. Generally.
Yeah, I actually
so,
understand that.
So,
like, I would just say, though, that the question of how the Trinity can be reconciled with simplicity is... thoroughly discussed in St. Thomas's Summa. I mean, he wasn't unaware of that difficulty.
So can we talk about existence, though, as one of the properties?
Yes, that's...
Because that
I'm
would
glad
be the
you brought
one
that
I would
up.
Most like to speak about. So
I'm glad you brought that up, yeah.
So first of all, can you define for me what you mean by existence?
Yeah. Existence, it's a very, very important question, because in my tradition, in the Thomistic conception, there's actually no distinction whatsoever between God's essence, what he is, and his existence. In other words, the essence of God is the subsistent act of existence itself. Now, the question of existence I would define that as the quality of being real, of being actual, as opposed to just potentially, or as opposed to just potential. In order to exist, you have to be you have to be in a sense present in reality, as opposed to non-existence. We have an intuitive understanding of what that means, right? An acorn, for example, growing into the tree. Well, the tree doesn't yet exist because it doesn't have reality yet as a tree. It grows into the tree. And if I were to blow it up with dynamite, it would cease. That unified whole as a tree would cease to exist. There's simply
The tree would cease to exist, but obviously the molecules that made up the tree don't cease to exist.
Well, it's true, but if you're going to say that the tree is reducible to the simply its constituent molecules that make it up, I don't see how then we could understand the tree as a unified whole. That
why not?
That's whose growth?
It's an arrangement of molecules. You can understand an arrangement of molecules.
We can understand an arrangement, but if you're thinking of just an arrangement, then you have no means of. You have no means of understanding how that arrangement is truly a unified whole that is not simply reducible to this molecule, that aspect. There's no mechanism by which we could understand the tree as a unified.
Well, that's a weird thing, because obviously I can recognize a song even though it is made up of individual notes.
Well, if you get into that, though, I would actually deny that the song has. I don't think the song is a substance. The reason I distinguish that is because the song as a whole does not have any kind of.
So, are we talking about just specifically physical forms right now, then, and not conceptualizations? So we're talking solely about things that are tangible in the world that we can conceive with our senses, so that I just don't want the conversation to go off the rail, because a song can be
there's a reason perceptualized. I picked that example,
yeah,
like so I picked that example for a reason, but
yeah, but just for the sake of he seems to be saying that a song isn't real in his sense because it's only conceived by one sort of sensory perception. It's an auditory perception, as opposed to being able, like, you can touch a tree, you can see a tree, and you can't.
Well,
really
and most
like,
principally,
are you talking
though,
about tangible things? I just don't understand that component of the argument. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
Individual things that, in a sense, exist in and of themselves. Right. I use the example of a tree because when the tree is growing, it's growing as a unified whole. It's not growing as this part or that part or that piece of matter or that piece of matter. It's growing as a tree. When the tree receives nutrients, it receives nutrients for the sake of its whole being, of its whole essence, if you will. Or I could use the example of a human being.
Yeah, I was going to say the tree's not a great example because I've had trees with dead branches and sometimes the leaves fall off. You know, that's not necessarily a great example.
Well, it's true. You know, the leaves do fall off. But, of course, when the leaf falls out, the tree doesn't cease being that unified whole. And that's kind of the proof of what I'm saying here, is that if you
no, but the
take
leaf obviously,
one...
the leaf can die. And if the leaf can die and the tree stays alive, then it's not a unified whole.
Well, it is, because it's unified in the sense of, I don't mean unified in the sense of all its parts are always hanging together perfectly. I mean unified in the sense that it is an intelligible, distinct, unitary object.
Okay. So our conceptualization of the tree doesn't die if one leaf falls off of it. We'll still look at it and recognize
right,
it.
Right, because it still has its growth is intrinsic to itself. If you pick a leaf off the tree is still a tree, even though it has lost one of its...
But you could drop a note from the song, for his analogy, and it would still be a song. It might not be a necessarily good song if some of the notes are off key, but it would still be considered a song. So I'm not understanding why we're getting off of his initial proposition that he brought.
Well, it's okay. I think I understand now what he meant by existence.
Okay.
But he also said that you said that essence and existence are, in God's case, the same thing. So I don't know what you mean by essence.
Right. The reason I
bring those that, must be synonymous if you phrase it that way.
In God, yes, and the and there's a very specific reason for that, and it's because in everything else, essence and existence are not the same; they are distinct. And the reason for that is because I'll go back to the tree example. If we can understand, you know, for example, you know, what a tree is or what a triangle is, for example, any question of what the thing is a different question. From whether or not it actually exists, and you know, for example, if existence were a necessary property of what it means to be me, then I would have always existed. I could not have come into existence, or I wouldn't be able to die. I wouldn't be able to go out of existence. The tree, for example, if existence were part of what it means to be a tree, then the tree would have always have had to exist because it would be baked into its nature, its definition. Now, if that's the case, then if the essence of the tree, the definition, the nature of the tree, is wholly other than the property of existence, then it must be said that it does not possess existence intrinsically. It has to get it from without. It has to get it. It has to be derived.
Okay, you're gonna have to back up here. So essence is what? A label? Essence is an abstraction. What is
not that? Just the label? Because if we're just, you know, the tree, for example, it's really there. It's outside of my mind, and it's really growing, you know, as a whole outside of my mind. Essence is. It is a concept, of course. The word essence correlates to a concept, but it means essentially what it means for the thing to be itself, or maybe I'll phrase it a different way. I guess you could say the definition of the thing, but I don't want to confuse that into being just our mere mental conceptualization of it, because I thoroughly believe that things exist outside of my mind, and they have and the understanding of what a thing is can be had and independently of our minds, but it's essentially what the thing is, what it is, it's you could say its nature.
So it's an abstraction. It's an abstraction.
It correlates to an abstraction, but it's not just an abstraction, because the tree still exists outside of my mind, but
your conceptualization of it is based on your perception of the tree. And we agree that a tree is a tree because we have unified consensus of that perception. So we've all seen trees and we all agree that that's a tree. So that's a unified perception.
It's gotten
through consensus. Yeah. And that is how we,
independently know right. it. Right. But
so that doesn't lead to, I mean, the only reason that we know that tree exists is through that unified perception and through that consensus that perception is real, because we can look at other people and say, "You see that tree? Yeah, I see that tree. Like everybody see that tree. We all know that's a tree, right?"
But even if we didn't know the specific qualities that go into the nature of the tree, which has to be discovered through, let's say, science, mm-hmm. through observation, through everything else, right. we can still have an intuitive knowledge that this is one thing, that is another.
Right.
We can still know distinctions, even if we don't know the nature of those distinctions. And those distinctions outside the mind correlate to what I will call, and what a lot of other philosophers throughout history will call, essence. In other words, that and which essence, makes something this, and lives, that which makes something
so because
that.
Essence is basically an abstraction, I know you call it an abstraction plus, or whatever.
Abstraction derived from reality.
Okay. Okay, so in essence, so for example, my idea of Gandalf the Grey is not, you know, that's I just have an idea of what he should look like, and maybe it's Ian McKellen, and maybe it's not.
Exactly. He looks like Steve McRae, actually.
He actually does.
So you're saying that in essence, so just simple abstraction is not an essence somehow. So, but like an abstraction, obviously this needs to be.
Well, the essence is how real things. They're not just abstractions, but you picked up on a good point because you said you brought up the example of Gandalf, and that kind of proves my point because
we should get there.
Well, I mean, going back to the essence existence distinction, if we can conceptualize Gandalf, we have thereby proven that the notion of essence, even though Gandalf doesn't exist, we still, when we conceptualize Gandalf, we still conceptualize it through the lens of, the notion of essence, the notion of definition, the notion of a specific nature, this being that, and this being something else.
Right, but my impression
that's still distinct from existence.
Also, so there's a couple things. So the fact that all of us in this room can picture him doesn't mean he's real, but also
exactly
all of us are not necessarily picturing him the same. So
that's true.
So in essence, doesn't correlate necessarily. Like I can imagine we may all be imagining different trees because maybe I'm imagining a pine tree because I heard Kent Tobin say 19 yesterday.
What's essential to the argument, though, is not so much that we all have a perfectly accurate understanding of what the thing is, but we can still have intuitive knowledge that this is this and that is that. In other words, this is such, but it is not that.
But that would correlate with a reality. Like we have a concept of a tree because we can see trees, right? But you're saying we can't see your God, but yet we have a concept of him.
Well, the point is the point in this whole discussion, though, is to you get to the question of does, like, in trees or in anything that we experience directly, is the question of its existence other than the question of what the thing is? For example, you know, with the triangle, it's part of the nature of a triangle to have three sides, right? It's not part of the nature of a triangle that it necessarily exists. Triangles could go out of existence tomorrow, and yet we would still have that. We would still be able to distinguish
because they exist
what a triangle is on the one hand.
Well,
and
triangle is
that
a proper triangle is a property, not a thing.
Yeah. And we've already had a conceptualization of it because it exists for us now.
A lot of geometrical mathematicians would disagree with that. They would say a lot of them believe in geometrical realism, but that's of course just an example.
But the picture that I get in my head of a triangle is what I was shown in school when they taught geometry, right? Like I didn't dream about it and just come to that realization that a triangle exists, right? I would still have to be shown a triangle.
Well, that's exactly true, but
in reality.
Right, but my point is, when we experience things in reality, we can still make the distinction between what something is and that it is, and that it exists. And that's evidenced by the fact that, for example, George H.W. Bush. I know who George H.W. Bush is. And if he died tomorrow, because he's pretty old, we would still understand that there's we could still talk about George H.W. Bush, right? His essence, his nature, his what he is, as George H.W. Bush is a different question from whether or not he exists. 'Cause he could die tomorrow, and yet that would still be.
Yeah, so how does that relate to God then? Because I think we're all
it relates to God because if in all of the things of our experience, if existence is not an intrinsic property of any of these essences, then existence would necessarily have to be derived because it's not intrinsic to anything.
What do you mean by derived?
It would received from without. From without.
Okay. So that's, which is exactly why I asked you all that questions up front. So about soundness and versus validity and how you would how you would check it. So you check it versus reality.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, like, I think, what was the example we talked about? Basically, you would check to see, we talked about, whether all humans are mortal. And I said, well, we check that to me, because as soon as we find an immortal human, then we have to reevaluate.
Yeah.
So, we would validate what you just said by saying, well, can we find any evidence to support it, even if it seems like you're presenting something that, in a way, if I'm hearing it right, you're presenting something that might be valid, but I don't think I agree with the premises.
Okay, so, but which premises specifically don't you?
Well, you haven't really presented an argument. I'm kind of inferring one.
That's true.
Yeah, put your argument briefly in syllogistic form, and then Paul can address it. Would that be okay?
Do you
think you can do that in sort of like a brief, concise way?
Yeah, I actually have a picture from my video on the subject that has a few premises outlined.
Okay.
Let me get it up here.
Sure, of course. And then once you have it up, if you could just present it briefly, because we want to make sure that we give Paul equal time too.
Yeah,
he's been assimilating, I think, the argument to make sure that he understands it well, but we want to make sure we give him equal time to.
Yeah, it's just only a few. Okay, here it is.
For sure.
We do like pictures.
Yeah, pictures are great. So, I'm not sure if we can present them right now.
Yeah, I have no idea how to do that.
Make a picture in our mind, classical theater.
So premise one, it's only three premises, or four in a conclusion. Okay,
fantastic.
Premise one, essences, which is just to say individual things that are intelligible as distinct objects, exist. Premise two, if each essence is not the same as its existence, then those essences are contingent. Premise three, if all essences are contingent, then considered in and of themselves, intrinsically, they do not have, or they do not possess, existence. Premise four, just refer back to premise one's, that essences, which is just to say individual things that are intelligible as distinct objects, exist. Conclusion, therefore, there is that whose existence and essence is one and the same, such that it is subsistent existence itself, and to this we give the name God. And then we can go over, questions about those premises and whatnot, but sure. That is the argument.
Okay. That's a lot of words.
so many words. I have the best words.
Number one, so essences exist. That's
in other words, individual things exist.
Well, no, you said individual things and essences.
That essences are the abstraction. Distinct objects.
So my glass exists, the tree exists, I exist. But you said the essence was an abstraction of the thing.
Well, they are individual things that that are distinct from each other, and that implies that we can have knowledge that they are distinct from one another. I use the word intelligible, understandable, because it.
I just want to make sure you're not trying to say that an abstract thing exists.
Right. Well, I think
you described essences as an abstract, so I want to make sure you're not trying to say that an abstract exists. A triangle doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well,
triangle shaped things exist, but triangles don't exist.
Okay. I'm convinced that they do. I don't think that's as necessary.
Well, it seems like premise four follows from premise four and one are the same.
No, I mean the question of mere abstraction apart from a particular thing.
Well, I think you were using the word exist in number one and number three in ways that are inconsistent, so I want to make sure that I'm right about that. So,
okay.
You're trying to say essences. When you say essences exist in number one, do you mean things exist? Physical things exist? Or do you mean the idea about the concept of the physical thing exists?
Well, it's, I guess I could just go with things, because I don't really want to have a debate about, you know, realism versus conceptualism.
Sure, here, I just want to, but I'm mainly, if you are jumping ahead to what I'm talking about, I really think you're using exist in different ways in number one and number three. So I just,
you mean essence?
I don't have it in front of me because I can't see it, so right, I'm just remembering.
Right. Okay, yeah, premise three is, if all essences are contingent, then considered in themselves, they do not exist. And premise one is that essences exist.
Right. So, but so in number three, you're saying that because an essence can only apply, Gandalf can never be an essence because he doesn't exist, but Paul can be an essence because I exist. That's what you're saying. That's, so you're actually you're trying to define something into existence here. You're trying the definition of essence. By definition, essence is an abstraction of something that exists. Am I getting that right?
Well, what I mean by essence is the way that we can distinguish essence from existence. I suppose I can concede the point that in a certain sense, what we are talking about is abstract, in that when we say that, you know, the essence of a triangle is that it has three sides, that takes abstraction. We are deriving from a particular triangle certain aspects that go into what it is. So when you take the essence and you consider it purely in itself, that is abstract, but it's not abstract in the sense that it's just in the mind, since I think that the forms are, you know, inherent in particular objects, but they're, when you extract them from particular things, yes, in the sense they are abstract. So I suppose I'll concede that point.
Okay, so then I would say premise one is not really true. Premise one is, you're saying an abstraction exists. But an
abstract- Well, it's certainly, would you not say that, you know, did you, just because we conceive of an essence through abstraction, that doesn't mean that the essence doesn't reflect reality? I mean,
well, I seriously don't know what an essence is, if it's not
the abstract. Right. It's what a thing is, essentially. It's its definition.
So it's a description of a thing? Like if I have an object in,
right, the intrinsic the intrinsic whatness of a thing, essentially. I mean would you not concede that for example there's a substantial difference in objective reality between a human being and a stone?
Absolutely, but I bet I could use just as many words to describe the stone as I could use to describe the human.
But well, how many words you use, that's the that's not as
okay. You're right. Yeah, okay, that's not, but it's okay. So there's a difference between a stone and a human,
right? Fine. And that difference is intrinsic to the things in themselves. That's not just in our minds. That's reflective of reality. So you have,
but you can find difference in between imaginary things, I think, is what, like, I could conceive of something that doesn't exist and conceive of another thing that also doesn't exist.
Exactly.
And so I could define, I could make, yeah, a distinction between those two things, but exactly, they're complete, yeah, abstractions because, right, they don't exist. So do they fall within premise one, the things that I conceived in my mind?
They actually would fall within premise two, because you're essentially conceding the point that we could have a question about whether something exists, and that's, mm-hmm, different from the question of what something is.
No, but I think in premise one, you're just saying that an essence happens to be an abstraction of a real thing.
Right. What an essence is. Because those things I conceived in my mind, could they not have an essence? Because I conceived of them and I could explain them. I could articulate what they look like. And somebody else, like, I could draw them a picture of what it is. They could, yeah, well, and that makes it tangible.
Right. You're referring to, I would say, yes, you're referring to the notion of an essence, the quiddity, the whatness, right? The the quality of what something is. You're right. You're taking that and applying it to real things and to imaginary things. But the fact that you have applied them to real and to imaginary things means that there's a distinction between what something is and that it is. There's a distinction between just essence, what it is, and its existence. Because when you conceive of an imaginary thing, you're still conceiving it as a distinct, a distinct thing. You know, if
so
you
it has
conceive
an essence.
Of, right.
So my imaginary
conceive,
thing has an essence. Does my imaginary thing that I imagine that nobody else has, that even if I've never conveyed right. what it is to anybody else, and it
right. well,
only
a thing,
exists in my mind, does it have an essence?
Well, my point is, a thing can only have an essence. It can only have an essence if it exists. So existence and essence are not separable. We can, but they're still distinct. They're still different questions.
Mm-hmm. This is where it gets confusing to me, because if everything is based on our perception and I'm perceiving something that I imagine, what is the differentiation? Because
existence.
Everything that I perceive in the world, the only reason it is tangible is the only reason I know it's tangible is based on consensus. Other people have told me that they also perceive the same thing,
right.
and
well,
we
when,
have consensus that it's tangible.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still a perception to me. It's still perceived by me and me only. It's a sole
yeah.
perception. So I could conceive of a perception, one that I've manifested of my own, and it could be just as tangible to me as all other things that I perceive. So how do I differentiate that imaginary thing, its essence, from the essence of things that do tangibly exist in the world in order
mm-hmm.
for your first premise to hold any water?
Well, the differentiae would be the question of existence.
Right.
It would be the question of whether that actually has existence. But in posing that question, you do concede the the point that we can talk about the question of essence, the question of what something is.
So the premise one is things that exist exist. That's premise one. Since essence is defined as a description of things that exist, so essence is things that exist exist.
I suppose you could word it that way.
Okay, so things that exist exist. What's premise two?
That if each essence is not the same as its existence, then those essences are contingent. We can unpack that a bit.
Okay, so if the idea, I guess that's what we've been talking about. If the idea relates to a real thing, it's an essence. If an idea doesn't relate to a real thing, it's not an essence.
Well, it wouldn't. The question of essence in general, the point is that the question of essence in general is a different question than existence, about whether or not it exists in reality.
How do you know something exists in reality, though, if not through your perceptions? And if your perceptions are conflated
yeah.
with essence, then that's where it gets confusing to me.
Right.
Is
well, it is through sense. I would concede, you know, it is through sensation.
Mm-hmm.
But through sensation, we can distinguish, for example, this from that and that from this. And in distinguishing this from that, we have a conception of what something is, of you know, the philosophical term for that is quiddity.
So the fact that we can draw differentiations between things, like I can
right.
look at a can and tell that it's different from a boat.
Yes.
Because I have a conception in my mind.
Right.
I've built a mental schema that tells me
right.
that a boat looks similar and or something like
yeah.
this shape. It has these properties.
Mm-hmm.
These properties are the properties that I attribute to something that I have decided is labeled boat.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
If it has these properties, it falls into the category of boat in my schema, in my mind, based on my classification scenarios that I've built up. So,
yeah, but it can't be an essence unless it's a real boat. You can't just imagine a boat.
No. Yeah. Well, see, that's what gets me.
Well, that's the point, though, is that you're conceding the point that the question of essence is altogether distinct from the question of existence. When I
only
say
because
that essence
only
is,
because you've defined it that way.
Right.
Is it though? Because is it just because I've defined it that way, or is it because that's how it is in reality? I mean, I think it's that's how it is in reality. Because clearly, if the question of whether or not something exists can be answered simply within the nature of that thing, then that thing would have always existed. The thing could not have gone out of existence because that would have been part of what it is.
But I don't think that it can.
The chat had a good thing. They were saying that instead of saying essence, just say what something is.
Well, yeah. I use the word essence because that's what the argument is classically called. But
yeah, but it seems like the word essence just seems to be, you know, it just changes definition constantly instead of we don't seem to be nailing it down.
Right. And that's why I guess what I felt like number one and number three were doing was they were playing on the English word.
I guess I'll just use the descriptor of, you know, what something is essentially, what goes into the nature of the thing.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. As distinct from others.
So the nature of a thing exists. So things have properties.
In other words, when we talk about something having a nature or something, being able to talk about what something is, that's reflective of reality. That's really all I'm saying, is that that's something that we can talk about without too much controversy, that we can simply talk about what something is, that there's truth to the idea of something having a nature as distinct from something else.
And then premise two is essentially that that exist have properties.
Well, if each essence, it's actually quite different than that. If each essence, you know, if each nature is not the same as its existence, then those essences or natures would be contingent. And that's the big one, because and that's the question we would have to ask. For example, is, you know, we can know all sorts of things about a tree, but is existence part of the nature of that tree? Definitionally, is that part of what it means to be a tree, essentially, necessarily?
And what answer do you want to give for that question?
My answer is no.
You want to say that existence is not part of being a tree?
Does that mean a tree can exist irrespective of it of existence?
Well, what I'm saying is, they're not separable. In other words, you can't just have the nature of a tree floating out somewhere. But my point is, existence has to be imparted to the tree. The tree has to derive existence from without. Because if you say that existence is a property of that tree, then what are you really saying? You're essentially saying that part of what it means to be a tree is to exist. But if that were true, then it couldn't go out of existence, because existence would be part of what it is, part of its makeup.
But doesn't that presuppose that existence can't be finite?
How would it presuppose?
Because you said
I think that's the logical consequence.
Part of being that tree would mean that it exists and then it wouldn't be able to go out of existence, and that's why it can't be a component of that tree. But yeah. If existence is finite, then of course it can.
But I don't think so. How could existence
be finite? Because the tree stops existing when it dies, and the components of the tree become a part of another essence.
Yeah, but the question of existence as such, when you consider it in itself, mm-hmm. is simply to be without qualification.
Yeah, but the components of the tree continue to exist. The particles of the tree. The individual components continue to exist, but the tree as an essence no longer exists.
But so, it ceases to exist precisely because it loses existence.
Right.
And so that's why existence can't go into what it means to be a tree.
That's confusing to me.
Well, because if existence were part of what it means to be a tree, just existence. Remember, if you consider existence purely in itself, existence is shared by everything.
Isn't existence what a part of what it means to be anything that's recognizable and can be perceived?
That existence is shared by everything, I concede. That it is a part of any given nature, I deny. And that's because
I think that's where we part ways.
but the point is, if existence were part of what it means to be you,
mm-hmm.
if existence just in itself were part of what it means to be you, then everything else would have to be you, because everything else shares existence. You know, for example, if John Smith,
existence isn't ubiquitous though.
Let me explain that a bit.
Okay.
If John Smith, right. If part of what it means to be John Smith is that he exists, or not that he exists, but if existence were part of what it means to be John Smith just in itself,
mm-hmm.
then everything else would have to be John Smith, because other things have existence and they're not John Smith.
Yeah,
the point that the reason that can be is because existence isn't intrinsic to this or that. It's from without.
So
it's derived.
Okay, give Paul
part of being Coca-Cola is that you're carbonated. That doesn't mean that everything carbonated is Coca-Cola. Like, that's ridiculous.
Well, the point is, can you unpack that a little bit more?
Sure. Yeah. You're just saying because I said that, so Shannon existing, you know, Shannon is part of what she is. She exists. And you're saying, well, that can't be true because then everything that exists has to be Shannon. Well, that's a component fallacy. That's like saying, because I have my rum and coke sitting here, you know, people would say, well, if a drink isn't carbonated, you know, Coca-Cola must be carbonated to actually be Coca-Cola. But that does not mean that everything that is carbonated is Coca-Cola. This apple is red, but that doesn't mean that everything is red is an apple. This does not follow. That's a component fallacy, not. How is Shannon existing if we say that it requires that all of a sudden means that everything that exists is Shannon?
Well, we're talking about existence just considered in itself. And the thing about existence, it's not a particular manner of being. Existence is not a particular manner of being. Existence is something that means to be real, the quality of being real.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if
which is why I asked you that up front.
Right, but if the quality of being real at all were something that is an intrinsic property of a thing, then that's not going to work, because when we talk about, and I guess I'm using a different reason now, but that I've also defended elsewhere. If you have the question of, see, the question of existence always, when you're talking about a particular thing, it's always going to presuppose the thing in question. Always. Because existence is shared by everything else. Existence is something that is shared by every single thing. That
only temporally, though. Only temporally.
Right, but it's something that is when we talk about the question of existence, that's always prior to what exists.
Right. So, but I also feel like, being composed of atoms is a property of existing. I know you don't think so. But I think so. And just because everything is composed of atoms, that doesn't mean that a shampoo bottle and my Coke are the same thing.
Well, right, but when we're talking about the question of existence as such, and then when you talk about atoms, you're still talking about two different things. Because when you say, for example, that a dog exists or an atom exists, we are simply in that phraseology, we are making a distinction between the thing and existence itself.
No, well, what I mean by existence is that the atoms are currently configured in the form that we attribute to a dog.
That's what you mean by existence?
Yeah. What do you think it means?
Just the quality of being real, having reality. See, the thing is, if you're talking about atoms, this also gets into the question of change. I mean, atoms, for example, they exist in this configuration or in that configuration. It's either they...
Right, and we label one configuration dog, and then maybe tomorrow we call that a corpse.
But the question of...
And it's the same atoms.
No dogs
can be corpses. Right, but
you're saying that... GC can't stand for any dogs dying in this stream.
Yeah.
Even metaphorically.
That's where I draw the line, guys.
You're saying that all these different atoms, they share... They all share the quality of existence.
I agree.
Okay. Well, if they all share the quality of existence, then you're still making a distinction between atom and existence.
No, yeah, I agree. It's a property, but that... Okay. Go ahead. Finish your thought. I'm sorry.
Again, we are always... Whenever you say that this... this is an atom, this is a tree, this is a human being. We are always, whenever we go into defining what this is or what that is, we never use the notion of existence to concretely define this or that, because we have intuitive knowledge that when we conceptualize an atom, the question of its existence is secondary. The question of its existence is posterior to the
thing that it's comprised. Of
the thing itself. The atom itself.
But we cannot have an essence. You defined essence as only applying to things that exist. Because you told me Gandalf can't have an essence.
Well, I said Gandalf can't have clearly an essence that reflects reality, but we can still talk about essence as distinct from existence precisely because we can conceptualize things that don't have existence. We can conceptualize them, and that proves that there is a distinction between what something is and that it is. Obviously, an essence cannot be real unless it exists, because existence is the quality of being real. But
okay, so premise one is premise one is off the table again. So you can have essences of things.
That's what makes it confusing to me is because essence is such an ambiguous term in that premise. Instead.
We can use
even if you use nature, it still becomes
what something is,
because things that you can conceptualize can fit inside that definition. So the definition would have to be tightened up so that it's only tangible things. So and that's almost impossible, because we're confined and constrained by our perceptions. We can only acknowledge things we perceive, and we only know that the things that we perceive are valid through consensus. That's how we decide that we're not crazy and that what we're perceiving is in fact valid. So it's difficult for me, and I hope you can understand why it's difficult for me to understand why that premise is true.
I don't know how long the show is. I want to kind of get to God too.
Yeah, true. Right. That's right.
Well, so the point about God, right? Well, the point about God was that if existence and essence are not the same in any given thing that we want to talk about. In other words, if then that would necessarily mean that existence would have to come from without with respect to any of these given things. And that's because when we talk about the existence of, say, a dog or, say, an atom or, say, a tree, the question of existence as such is prior logically to any specific thing that exists. And when we talk about, for example, an apple existing, the whole nature of the apple mm-hmm. is what's going to share in existence. And because of that, we have therefore made a distinction between what an apple is and its existence.
Let me jump ahead to God, because I think we're trying to
wrap. Right.
Yeah, because well, it's so, all still right. constrained by sensory perception.
Okay, so if that's true.
Let Paul jump ahead. Paul's if, jumping if, ahead to, yeah, let Paul, right. give Paul so a if, chance.
Well, my point is, if that's true, then existence would be derived. But if existence is derived, then that from which existence I've derived, if that's in the same category as something in which essence and existence are distinct, then again, existence would have to be derived for that. And existence would have to be derived for anything in which essence and existence are distinct. But if that's the case, then nothing could exist at all, because existence would always be derived. Existence cannot be derived forever. Existence cannot be derived infinitely, because then because then nothing could actually receive existence, because it would be forever derived. Existence would be derived forever. So the only thing that can safeguard one from the consequent of universal non-being would be reality in whom essence and existence are the same, okay. and they're not distinct. So that simply conceding the reality of subsistent existence itself, and then we can analyze that that logically through logical analysis, and then we can I think, and say Thomas Aquinas certainly thought that we can derive all sorts of divine attributes and even,
yeah, and so this is where like I don't agree with your premises, and I actually don't agree with the soundness of the argument, because when you test it, like you've defined something into existence, you're using essence in one way in premise one, you're using essence. Oh, there's a conceptual abstraction that exists, which you can say, well, in a mind, sure, maybe. And then in number three, you're saying you're using exists as material exists. And because you're using an abstractual existence and a material existence and then conflating them and saying, therefore, God.
It's just I'm not conflating them at all. I'm saying it's abstract only in the sense that we can, when we think of the essence as derived from the thing, then it's abstract. But the difference between, say, a tree and a dog is intrinsic to the tree and the dog. So they have a nature independent right. of
then,
minds.
But so then, you know, but by all this logic, nothing existed before the first human. Like on day one of creation, nothing existed. Day two of creation, nothing existed.
No,
oh, except you think it. You, oh, yeah, that's right. You think there's a God that,
no, what
that
I'm has saying it in its is, mind. What I'm saying is, the only reason the essence becomes abstract, right, is because we think about it. But when we think about it, we're deriving it from the thing itself. The difference between a tree and a dog is intrinsic to the tree and the dog, irrespective of whether humans exist or not. So the nature is still real in the thing, no, even if just, we weren't there to conceptualize
it. And you're just saying the description of a thing. And the description of a thing...
No, we're picking up on the intrinsic principles that distinguish this from that. And those are real in the things. When a dog barks, for example, versus a tree, those distinctions are real in the tree and the dog that differentiate
trees have barks so each other.
If I'm understanding correctly, you're saying yeah. if there wasn't a human there to perceive it and classify it, those differentiations would still exist. If we hadn't perceived them and classified them, they would still be
Right. Well, then a nuclear bomb went off, and
what happens? If
I think we would all agree that, you know, the sun would still exist, the Earth would still exist.
What would happen if the dog peed on the tree, though?
Well, then my whole argument is completely destroyed.
Asking the tough questions.
Yeah.
GC's here to get us all thinking.
I think we're gonna wrap it up. But I did have one last question for you, CT. Is you seem to believe in a God that wants people to believe in it, but I just watching the chat and listening to you, I think almost everybody is at least a little bit confused about the nature of this God and why they should believe in it.
Yeah, well, if I could just briefly, getting into like the very specific abstract questions that are raised in response to. Right.
But why would a God make it like premise? Why would a God that wants to be believed in make it so difficult?
Well, I don't think it's. I think if you're asking for absolute, irrefutable, rational proof, I think it's there, and I think unfortunately, I think. Conversationally, we were kind of on different strands of thought, so it wasn't able to come together as harmoniously. But if you're someone who needs that absolute rational proof, I think it's there, not just in this argument, but the argument from change, simplicity, contingency, whatever. I think those are actually simpler to expound upon. But when we were talking about just simplicity, we got to this argument. But anyway, I think. I wouldn't say it's rational proof, but I think various human experiences can be, it works for a lot of people. When someone sees a sunset, or when somebody has these ineffable human experiences, they don't see that as an obstacle. But if there's someone who needs absolute rational justification, I think it's there if they'd really try to look for it. And I try to do that with my channel, for example. So I don't think it's necessarily, like, someone doesn't have to go all through all these hoops to come to experience the divine. I don't believe that, but it's there if they need it.
All right, well, fair enough. Thanks for joining us, CC and Paul. Thank you, especially thank you Paul for stepping in when Ozzy couldn't make it.
I'm sure he'd have done a better job.
Super chat.
Oh, super chat.
There is a super chat. It says, this hurts my brain, but I still love you guys. Oh, there's another super chat.
I think next time I'll probably stick to a different argument than that. But it was kind of addressed to me. But
yeah, we never even really got to God. We haven't even flushed through premise one. Yeah.
I feel like that was the equivalent of the Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson, where they just argued about truth for
yeah,
2 hours.
I think that's probably it. Yeah.
But,
sorry, guys.
No.
No, it's fair.
It's partly my fault too.
Oh, and thank you, Tyler Preston, for the super chat. All right, so thanks everybody for joining us. We're gonna shut her down.
Yeah, and what are your guys' channels so that we know where to go find you? Where are your channels? Please, we'll start with Paul or Classical Theist. Go ahead. Where is your channel?
Mine is just if you type in Classical Theist and you see the avatar that I have now. Then
Perfect. And Paul, what is your channel? I've never heard of it.
On YouTube, it's Paulogia, PAULOGIA. And on Twitter and Facebook, apology with the number zero at the end.
Steve McRae said, "No amount of alcohol will ever make me forget this in super chat." So, thank you for the super chat, and also thank you, Steve, for helping or trying to help me out with with trying to set up the stream that failed. And thank you for the non sequitur show again for setting up the template that I hopefully will be using at some point in the future.
Yeah, maybe.
So see you guys in a couple of weeks. Bye.
Bye.